Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. This week, the seven tactics of unhealthy industries to make sure public health policies are halted in their tracks. Disturbing side effects in young ice users, the substances in your microbiome that might increase your health span, and study findings which, if they're right, could spark a debate about whether to add lithium to drinking water. It was a huge Danish study which found that people living in areas with higher than average levels of the metal lithium in their drinking water had lower chances of developing dementia. Lithium is best known for powering rechargeable batteries in mobile phones and as a treatment for bipolar disorder, an Australian discovery. One of the co-authors of an accompanying editorial on the study was Professor John McGrath, a leading psychiatric epidemiologist at the Queensland Brain Institute, and he's in our Brisbane studio. Welcome to the Health Report, John.
Hi, Norman.
What was known about lithium and dementia before this study?
Well, this is a very curious finding, but there had been clues to suggest that lithium in cell cultures and animal models may protect the brain from changes associated with dementia. And there'd been a handful of studies where they actually gave small doses of lithium, not the doses that we'd give to people with bipolar disorder, much lower doses. And then they looked at cognitive outcomes, and there was some evidence to suggest that lithium may protect and slow down cognitive decline. It wasn't completely solid evidence, though, Norman. It was mixed.
Right. And this is called microdosing in a sense, isn't it?
Exactly. They're very small doses. They are not homeopathy, though. They are for measurable doses.
So tell me about the study, because the Danes were alongside the Australians 50-odd years ago when John Cade discovered lithium helped bipolar disorder. So they've got form when it comes to lithium.
Yeah, it's a great story that I think Australians can be proud of. But as you say, John Cade, a Melbourne-based psychiatrist, published in 1949 that lithium was effective for treating bipolar disorder. And that I think, is still the most highly cited paper in the Medical Journal of Australia. And then the work leapt over to Aarhus, where I'm working now part-time in Denmark, where there was a psychiatrist working at the hospital whose brother had bipolar disorder. His name's Morten Skau. And he started to do trials, and that really triggered off the cascade that lithium is actually a very effective treatment.
So tell me about this study that they did.
So this was done by some colleagues of mine. I'm not an author on this study, by Lars Kessin and people in Copenhagen.
I'm impressed that you're Danish, by the way, John.
This is, it's very good to prevent dementia, Norman, if you can learn a new language at my age. This is why people like I go to Denmark. So they have fantastic record linkage. So what Lars did was he identified for everyone in the entire kingdom of Denmark, everyone that had had dementia over many years, and they identified 73,000 individuals who died from dementia. They matched them with precision virtuoso epidemiology, matched on month of birth and same sex, did not have dementia at the age of onset of the case. And then they were able to look at the...
And they matched them with 10 times that number of people, 733,000 people.
Exactly. So we're really at industrial scale epidemiology, over 700,000. And then they were able to access data that measured the concentration of lithium in drinking water in many parts of Denmark, and they filled in and smoothed it out. And they know where everyone lives, Norman. Everyone who
there's no escaping.
They've got your CPR number, it's called, and I've got one now as well. But they're able to see the address.
So what did they find?
So they found that if you lived in an area with low lithium concentration in your drinking water, then you had an increased risk of dementia. And it was quite a startling finding. It went in the direction they hypothesized. So low lithium, increased risk; high lithium, decreased risk. And that was the finding.
But it wasn't linear, because if you expect something, cause this is an association. This is not cause and effect. And if it was cause and effect, you'd expect it to be a straight line: more lithium, less Alzheimer's, but it kind of tailed off after a while.
Yeah, it was a bit bendy. We're used to this in nutritional epidemiology. So too much, too little is not quite right. So you need that Goldilocks zone. And
So it doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't cause and effect.
No, I think that in nutritional epidemiology, we don't expect to see a perfect linear relationship. So if you're looking at scurvy and vitamin C, it only really kicks in below a certain level. And above that, there's no linear relationship at all. So I think we need to be careful about over expecting nutritional epidemiology to be linear.
So you wrote this editorial with Michael Burke, who's an international authority on bipolar disorder and lithium, and you kind of had five bob each way about whether or not the findings were real in this study.
Yeah, I think Michael and I are very cautious, but the bottom line is that, as your listeners know, dementia is a very, very difficult illness to treat. We don't have effective treatments to delay it or to cure it. So we are desperately looking for new clues, and that's what I like about this one, and I'm particularly attracted to modifiable risk factors. So we've got a long way to go, but if lithium in the drinking water is associated with reduced risk, as you say, if we can push it over to causality, and we're not there yet, then this could be quite an important breakthrough.
So how do you get to cause and effect?
Well, it's not so easy in long latency disorders like dementia. To do clinical trials, randomized clinical trials, you'd need to keep people under observation for many, many decades, and that's not really feasible. There are some tricks that epidemiologists could do, where they could do internal migration studies where people live in one area with, say, high lithium and they move to low, and we could see whether their risk changes and vice versa. But I think we need to look for natural experiments where water supply changes, and then people may go from low to high and see whether there's any palpable change in the incidence of new cases of dementia.
Now, I assume that they corrected for things like people in low lithium areas might also be poorer and less educated, things that are associated with higher rates of dementia.
Yeah, the Denmark is a very homogenous society, but they did adjust for population density, and the findings persisted. But as your listeners know, there could be unmeasured confounding. There may be something that varies coincidentally with lithium concentration, which could also be a cause. But they have not identified what those variables are.
So we're a long way from putting it in the drinking water. What about studying in people who are heading for dementia, who are starting to show thinking and memory problems?
Well, I think that if you have people at high risk, they may have a particular type of genetic risk factor or other family history, then it may well be that this group would be suitable for an RCT, because you have concentrated the risk of the onset of dementia, and the outcome may be a delayed onset. So it wouldn't be that lithium would cure dementia or stop dementia, it just may delay it slightly.
So don't chew on your mobile phone just yet.
Definitely not. I don't want your listeners to do anything rash with lithium.
John, thank you. We'll come back to you to talk about what you're learning about schizophrenia from your work in Denmark on a later date. I'm sure it's fascinating.
I look forward to it.
John McGrath, who's a professor of psychiatry at both the Queensland Brain Institute and Aarhus University in Denmark. And you're listening to The Health Report here on RN, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. Health span, as opposed to lifespan, is really about living longer as young as possible. Lithium might just help do that with the brain, but research in the United States suggests that substances produced by some bacteria in our microbiome, the bugs that live on and inside our bodies, may increase health span and indeed fertility, at least in the animals that they've tested. The substances are called indoles, and the research group leader was Daniel Kalman of the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at Emory University in Atlanta.
Thank you. Nice to be with you today.
What's the background to this study?
A lot is known about how we make animals and organisms live longer, but we don't know a lot about how we make animals live better. So our interest was understanding not so much longevity and living till we're 100 or 200 or 300, but understanding how we can live better for longer.
And where did the insight come from that it might be to do with the microbiome and chemicals that come from that?
The scientific community has been studying longevity in model organisms for quite a long time. We know we can get flies, worms to live much longer, and we know that we can make mutations that will double or even triple their lifespans. But these organisms often are very closely associated with bacteria, and my lab has been using C. elegans as a sort of biosensor for microbially produced products. And we found these products affected how worms, for example, deal with stressors. Stress tolerance is a key part of staying healthy. The idea that you can handle whatever the world throws at you is a key part to living longer. And if you can do that, then your health span will improve. So with that in mind, we started looking specifically at health span measures, and that's what brought us to this project.
Tell me about this chemical indole.
Indole is a small molecule. It's secreted by many different kinds of bacteria, including bacteria that are considered probiotics. It's an ancient molecule. It's also produced by plants. And in plants, it governs root growth. It's particularly at high levels in plants like cruciferous vegetables like kale and broccoli. So we come into contact with indoles as part of our diet, and we also come into contact with them as part of our native microbiota.
And this is what you suspected might be the substance that's related to healthier longevity.
Our approach a few years ago was to actually purify chemicals that were produced by bacteria and ask whether they had effects on worm stress tolerance. We found that certain bacteria that produced indoles made the animals more tolerant to stress, and bacteria that didn't produce indoles had the opposite effect.
And in this particular experiment, you tested this on a variety of species to see what the effects were on not just stress, but metabolic resilience.
Correct. We looked in worms, we looked in flies, and we had the same effect. Flies fly higher. And then we looked in mammals.
You're kidding. They fly higher once they're high on indole, so to speak.
So to say. Actually, they crawl higher in this case. But the fact that organisms as diverse as worms, flies, and mice all show the same kinds of health span and stress tolerance led us to conclude that evolution had hung on to this very important pathway over hundreds of millions of years.
And what you found was that the genes expressed then in these animals were much more of a younger profile of gene expression rather than an older profile.
Correct. We express different gene sets when we're old and when we're young. And when we looked at the genes that were regulated by indoles, retained a more youthful expression profile in older animals when indoles were present.
And it seemed to increase fertility, that the animals given this seemed to be fertile longer into older age.
Yes, that was a finding that we didn't initially expect. Worms usually cease reproduction at about 5 days of adulthood, but we saw these genes expressed quite robustly at 2 to 3 times that, namely 10 to 12, 15 days of adulthood. The animals live about 25 days. So that was a remarkable finding, I think.
Now, many's the basic science research that's foundered on the fact that humans are not mice, they're not worms, they're not fruit flies. To what extent is there a jump here to be made to humans?
The basic understanding of pathways or signaling molecules very often begins with these model systems. When we see something that's very highly conserved across worms and flies, mice, then we have a pretty good inkling that evolution has held on to it. And so we can now study these processes in higher organisms with careful development, testing, safety, profiling.
Speaking of which, did any of the animals come to grief because of the indole?
No, they actually tolerated it very well. I mean, I think when you jump from mice to people, it's a big jump. You have to develop molecules that can be appropriately delivered to people. You have to develop a way that they're absorbed and metabolized that is specific to humans and not to mice. And you have to develop appropriate safety metrics with molecules. So we've got a long way to go to be able to take the observations that we've made and translate them into humans. But that path is actually fairly clear.
And in the meantime, eat your broccoli and your kale, your cruciferous vegetables.
Yeah, it's hard to know how much you'd have to eat to be able to get benefit. But in general, vegetables are good for you.
Daniel Kalman, thanks for joining us on the Health Report.
All right, thank you very much.
Associate Professor Daniel Kalman is in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. How much have you got to listen to the Health Report to know that your veggies are good for you? There are estimated to be 30-odd million users of methamphetamine globally. In its crystalline form, methamphetamine is called ice and has a wide array of side effects, quite apart from the effects on users' behaviour. One of the nastiest complications has been said to be strokes, both as brain hemorrhages and brain artery clots, ischemic stroke, especially tragic since they occur in young people. But there's been some controversy over whether strokes and methamphetamine use are truly linked. Well, until now, that is, if a study from the National Drug and Alcohol Centre at the University of New South Wales is right. Psychiatrist and senior researcher at NDARC, Dr. Julia Lappin, was the lead author, and she's in our Sydney studio. Welcome to the Health Report, Julia.
Thanks, Norman.
So what do people use methamphetamine for? What do they get out of it?
Well, methamphetamine is a stimulant drug, and people use it in order to get a high. Depending on the form of use, they can get a high very quickly or more slowly. So, for example, if you take methamphetamine as a tablet, it'll take longer to get your hit. If you inject or inhale, you'll get your hit slightly quicker.
And the route of administration is important when it comes to complications.
It absolutely is, Norman. Well, certainly as it turns out in the case of stroke, and this was a new finding from our study, which is really very interesting. We don't fully understand why that might be, but we do have some ideas.
What complications are there, before we get on to stroke, what other complications are there? I mean, so the behaviour is supposed to be very disorganised, disruptive, and the publicity is that it ruins people's lives.
That's right, Norman. And methamphetamine is associated with a wide range of negative health impacts. These range from cardiovascular effects, so you get accelerated hypertensive changes over time. You get serious cardiac abnormalities. And you also get a range of psychiatric effects, including depression, anxiety, and psychosis associated with methamphetamine use. But what we wanted to look at in this study is whether there is a link between methamphetamine use and stroke, and particularly whether that was the case in young people.
And why was there any doubt? It would be a pretty dramatic thing, a stroke in a young person, and surely it's obvious if they've been on ice.
That's absolutely right. Stroke is a rare event in a young person. Because the majority of users of methamphetamine are younger, that's not to say that there aren't older users. However, the majority of people who use ice are younger. If you see a stroke in a young person, it's important to be vigilant to the idea that meth may be one of the underlying causes.
So how did you study this?
Well, we gathered evidence together from a range of studies that had been done at different levels. So we looked at all case reports that had been conducted over the past 70 years. We looked at population studies, clinical studies, and post-mortem studies. And together, by looking at that great range of evidence from multiple sources, we were able to put together pieces in the jigsaw and conclude that there is a link between methamphetamine use and stroke in young people, particularly a hemorrhagic type of stroke, which means someone has a bleed in their brain. And this is important because hemorrhagic or brain bleeds are much more likely to be fatal. And indeed, that's what we found in our study, that 1 in 3 young people who suffered a methamphetamine-related stroke died. This is very, very damaging. This is big news. It's catastrophic for anyone, any young person to have a stroke, but these are very high fatality rates.
And what happened to the rest?
Well, the good news is that about a quarter recovered. So the remainder, some 40-45%, were left with residual deficits caused by the stroke. So that they might be, for example, speech and language difficulties, problems with vision, problems with walking or movement. So typically in a stroke, we expect to see one-sided weakness, and these sort of problems persist.
And what about ischemic stroke when it's caused by a clot?
That's right. So there is a link also between methamphetamine and ischemic stroke. It's not as strong. It's less likely to Methamphetamine use among young people is less associated with ischemic type strokes. And we think that the reason underlying that is the mechanism by which methamphetamine causes
I was going to ask you that. So what's going wrong?
Well, what methamphetamine does is it's a stimulant, and it massively increases your blood pressure when you take it, particularly if you inject, because you get a huge surge of methamphetamine and a dramatic quick effect straight into the bloodstream.
So it lifts your head off in a sense.
It does. And your heart is pumping, your blood pressure goes through the roof. And in anyone who is already vulnerable to having a stroke, for example, because they have, some of your listeners will have heard of perianeurysms, any sort of malformation or weak point in a vessel in the brain, you can imagine that if you have blood pushing through at really high pressure, that could cause a rupture at a weak point. And we know that in young people who have a pre-existing abnormality, they're more likely to have a stroke of this type. And methamphetamine, with its huge surge of blood pressure, is going to cause that.
But you also found there was a disease of the blood vessels itself. It was damaging the blood vessels.
And that's the more... So the acute effect of methamphetamine, even after one use, you could have a stroke if you had a pre-existing abnormality. But what we also found was that in people who have continued use over time, they build up their risk factor of having that type of stroke because they develop weaknesses in their vessel walls. Methamphetamine can directly have a toxic effect on your vessels and cause them to balloon and therefore form weak points. And it can also cause, through a process of sort of accelerated hypertensive changes, that's accelerated high blood pressure changes, cause people's blood vessels to be more prone to rupture.
Not good news.
No.
Okay, don't start it to begin with. But my understanding is that the evidence base for addiction treatment for ICE users is pretty poor. We don't really have good ways of getting people off ICE.
You're right, Norman. And I think there's a lot of work to be done. We don't.
Which sounds extraordinary for such a common... Well, it's a relatively... It's much rarer than alcohol and smoking, but nonetheless, within the illicit group, it's a fairly common drug.
It's common. And it causes a lot of problems. But as in many branches of medicine, it can take many years for us to identify problems and many further years for us to identify effective treatments. We do know that long-term residential rehab can be useful in the treatment of methamphetamine.
Community.
That's right. But of course, you need to have someone motivated to change and really want to give up before that type of treatment would be useful.
And a government willing to pay for it. They don't like paying for it either.
That's another point.
Julia, thank you very much for joining us on the Health Report.
Thanks very much, Norman.
Julia Lappin, who's a psychiatrist and senior researcher at the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre, National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. You're listening to the Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. There's a list of public health measures which could make an impact on the population's health and well-being and reduce healthcare costs as well, from pricing alcohol properly to reducing pollution to taxing sugar to regulating unhealthy food advertising. But the task of putting such policies into practice is enormous and usually fought every step of the way by vested interests. Just remember the battle over plain packaging for cigarettes here in Australia. How much harder is it then for much poorer countries than Australia who can't go to international courts? Rob Moody is Professor of Public Health at the University of Melbourne but has been working at the University of Malawi for the last couple of years. Rob has written articles for the American Journal of Public Health and The Conversation recently on the seven tactics used by unhealthy industries to undermine public health policies. Rob's on the line from Blantyre in Malawi. Welcome to the Health Report, or welcome back to the Health Report, Rob.
Thank you, Nolan. Thank you.
So let's go through these seven tactics that unhealthy industries use to undermine public health policies. The first one you've got is attacking legitimate science.
Yeah, well, that's sort of you both attack the science and you then attack the scientists. You call it junk science or bad science. You attack the institutions or even the government agencies that might be against corporate interests. I mean, the classic in the US is that they're now attacking the Environmental Protection Agency, their own agency. And that's a way of making sure that you can try and diminish their influence, or if they have policies or regulations that they want to introduce to in any way limit the role of these unhealthy corporations. So that's the first one. They then really get stuck into the actual scientists. And I mean, you just mentioned about plain packaging. Well, Melanie Wakefield at the Cancer Council has been mercilessly attacked by the tobacco industry in Australia because, you know, her evidence is showing the fact that it works. So, and they can really intimidate people. I mean, it's pretty scary when the really big corporations that have got lots of money actually come after you. And intimidation does actually work, and it can often close down either scientists' work or their capacity, their actual willingness to speak publicly about
How far does this intimidation go? Does it go as far as litigation?
It certainly goes as far as threatening litigation. I mean, I remember the case in Melbourne when one of the law firms was suing Peter Gordon and Todd Harper, and I remember, you know, their faces blanching at this prospect. I mean, they were really, this was not a lot of fun at all. It was very, very powerful and intimidation. One of the interesting things about this is that often they don't want to actually push the litigation too far because of the process of discovery, so that, in fact, if they do go to the court case, then, you know, the other side can get access to documents. And we've seen in the tobacco case, when we get access to their documents, we see what they've been actually doing. We see that they've known, for example, that, you know, tobacco smoking caused cancer, but would never admit it. So they are careful in threatening, but not necessarily going through it.
So is there an element of come and get me from the people who are trying to get the public health policies in place?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's what is intriguing in looking at these tactics and you know, their way of sort of putting them all together so that they really do actually, they create the running and you know, they create arms length front organisations, they manufacture false debate, and then they insist on what's called the fairness doctrine or on balance. And I mean, if we look at the arms length front organisations, I mean, they're amazing ones in each area. There's the, you know, International Centre for Alcohol Policies, the Tobacco Research Institute, the International Life Sciences Institute, which is created by the Vice President of Coca-Cola. I mean, these are front organisations that purport to either fund research or do their own research. They have their own conferences. They have their own guest speakers. So they're producing what we would call alternative science. But they're very powerful because they have megaphone in terms of being able to amplify it across the globe and across some of the media. I mean, last week we even saw Australia's tobacco policies being attacked because they were no longer working. Well, they obviously are. Yet if you have...
This was the story where it was framed that we've stalled and people over 30 are not giving up smoking when, in fact, hundreds of thousands of people have given up smoking relative to a small number who haven't given up smoking. It was distorted
exactly.
Statistics.
And you know, the power of actually using sympathetic media and, you know, funding conferences, funding newsletters, funding so-called independence. This is the way that these groups work.
What can be done about this, and particularly in where you are in Africa, in poorer countries that don't necessarily have the resources, what tactics can you take to combat these seven tactics from very rich industries?
I mean, you need a network, you need a global network. You need, you know, people in wealthier countries who have the capacity to work with colleagues in places like Malawi. And we need to get very good at surveillance. We need to be able to watch what they do and constantly expose that. That's the way that it's worked so far. It is actually shining a light on what these tactics, what they do and what is actually happening in places like Africa, where, you know, the markets for tobacco and alcohol are expanding every day. So we really do need a global network to bring to bear the sort of scientific work and support people in places like this that really have very few resources.
Rob, thanks for joining us. Rob Moody is Professor of Public Health at the University of Malawi and the University of Melbourne. This has been the Health Report. I'm Norman Swan. See you next week.